that is the intention that he makes with this version and all, but he surely takes it for granted. Yes.
On the other hand, a limit has to be assumed in these relationships. For if the list be extended to one's ancestors and descendants and to the friends of one's friends, it will go on ad infinitum. But this is a point which must be considered later on. We take a self-sufficient thing to mean a thing which merely standing by itself alone renders life desirable and lacking in nothing, and such a thing we deem happiness to be. Moreover, we think happiness the most desirable of all good things without being itself reckoned as one among the rest. For if it were so reckoned, it is clear that we should consider it more desirable when even the smallest of other good things were combined with it, since this addition would result in a larger total of good, and of two goods, the greater is always the more desirable.
Yeah, now let us stop here. You see here this brief discussion, how far do you extend that? I mean, that it is clear that if you are happy for yourself, but your nearest and dearest are very miserable, your happiness will not be complete. But how far do you extend your nearest and dearest? Must cousins also come in like brothers and sisters? And if cousins, also cousins of the second degree, and where do you stop? No universal answer is possible. That is a simple illustration of the inexactness, of the lack of exactness in moral matters. In some cases, a very closely knit family, the cousins even count as much as brothers and sisters, and in other cases, perhaps not even all brothers and sisters are important for assessing one's own happiness. Is the question which Aristotle raises here by implication, which we read, is this. Will happiness be increased by intelligence and virtue? Or does happiness necessarily include intelligence and happiness? And Aristotle's general answer, as you will see soon, is the latter. So there cannot be happiness here and the virtues there, but the virtues are, as it were, the core of happiness. Now this question he tries to answer, and that is his final answer of the question of what happiness is, that comes in the next passage, of which we might perhaps read the beginning.
Happiness, therefore, being found to be something final and self-sufficient, is the end at which all actions aim.
Yeah, is the end of the practicable goods, would be perhaps more precise. Yes?
To say, however, that the supreme good is happiness will probably appear a truism. We still require a more explicit account of what constitutes happiness. Perhaps then we may arrive at this by ascertaining what is man's function.
Yes, now let us say work. Because the word function is not so grossly misused. And let us leave the simple word which I was using, the work of man. What is the work of man? Yeah?
For the goodness or efficiency of a flute player or sculptor or craftsman of any sort, and in general of anybody who has some work or business to perform, is thought to reside in that function.
And that work.
And similarly, it may be held that the good of man resides in the work of man.
Yeah. So Aristotle tries now to reach a solution to the question of what happiness is. Now, happiness is a good state of man. And not only a good state, but the best state of man. And now the question, Aristotle raises here the question, where is goodness located altogether? And he takes first the example of the arts or artisans. For example, say a carpenter. How do we distinguish a good carpenter from a bad or indifferent carpenter? By looking at the tables which the two carpenters produce. At the work. Now, let us try this with man. Is there not also a specific work of man as man by which we can distinguish between the good man and the bad man? Now, we must here note that therefore they translated by function. And the Greek word work, and I believe also the English word work, leaves it open whether the work is something outside, self-subsisting after it has been completed, like the table or the shoe, or whether the work is an action. Can one not say it? So, therefore, Aristotle, is there a work of man as man, a specific work of man? If that is so, then human goodness, and in particular the highest form of goodness, happiness, will consist in a specific work. And if you do not like the word work, say activity. But the Greek word ergon comprises both. The work in the sense of the like shoe or activity. And that Aristotle tries now to find in the sequel the answer to this question. But the general answer is this, that man's specific work, his specific activity, is rationality. And therefore the goodness of man will consist in the goodness of his rationality. I.e., if he uses his reason for destroying his reason, say, by becoming alcoholic, then he is a bad man. But if he cultivates his reason and makes the most of it and the best of it, then he's a good man. And there are certain minor but important distinctions, but secondary distinctions, into which I do not have to go now. So the answer which Aristotle arrives at in a few more steps, which we will consider next time, is this. Happiness consists in virtuous or excellent activity, but specifically human activity. A man may be an excellent tightrope dancer, but this does not make him an excellent man. Because tightrope dancing is not the activity characteristic of men. Men maybe only men can tightrope dance. I have no opinion on this matter. But it is surely not the activity characteristic of men. To be an excellent man means to be able to do the work of man in a reasoning in an excellent manner. And if this is so, we already include that the excellent man must have some means, because he means outside of his good intentions. He must be, for example, if he were completely paralyzed, could not even speak, then he cannot do the works of men. He is an unfortunate man, a proper object of compassion. But he cannot be an excellent man. How can we know how we would act if we were not paralyzed? And also, if it is true that there are certain activities of men which require a modicum of wealth, as was the case in prior to the age of affluence, then there will be quite a few human beings who will be unable to do the work of men, lacking the means of support. Very unfortunate, but Aristotle implies it cannot be changed. The main point is this. By speaking of virtuous activity, Aristotle includes the external means of conditions of happiness in his definition of happiness. And therefore disposes of the difficulty which he had made, with which he had confronted us shortly before. At the end of this section, which we just began, there is again a discussion of what I call method, meaning what is the degree of exactness to be expected in such matters, moral matters. There are altogether three discussions. It will be the third. We will come to that next time. Now we make here stop. Is there any question we would raise? Mr. Kirby?
When Aristotle says that the truth is to be preferred to one's friends, does this apply only to those who discuss ethics, or does it also apply to gentlemen simply?
Yeah, but as Aristotle means it here, it does not apply to non-philosophers. If it means it even understood in a different sense, for example, must a friend be a witness before a court against his friend and say the truth rather than save his friend? That, I suppose he would say in this case, unless it is a terribly tyrannical regime, he would have to say the truth because he's under oath after. But as he means it here, the question arises only for philosophers, because the truth is theoretical or speculative truth.
And in that sense, again, we see the difference between the man who addresses the audience and the nature of the audience itself. Because certainly the audience itself would be more inclined to prefer their friends to the truth, as a general rule.
Yeah, you could almost say that is the definition of the non-philosopher. Now, any other point?
Could I ask you a question about what you said last time?
Yes. I mean, that would be a very bureaucratic procedure. I think in today's meeting, only today's subjects would be discussed.
I didn't quite understand what you said about Plato's view of mathematical objects. You said that they were ultimately not ideas for him.
Because the idea of the dog, false justice for that matter, has one and only one idea of the dog, and only one idea of justice, one idea of man. But if you take number five, there are many fives. I can easily prove it to you. 5 + 5. The first 5 is not the second 5. You can invert the order, but still there are the main 2 5s. You cannot make additions of ideas, but you can make and must make additions of numbers, and for that matter also of magnitudes, of course. You can add one triangle to another, one circle to another, and so.
But couldn't you say that each of those fives or each of those triangles are individual fives?
Yeah, then you would have to say there is an idea of the triangle, or the idea of five, higher than the fives which occur in operation. There were people who understood Plato. There exists in Plato a teaching called of ideal numbers. And some people understood ideal numbers to be this idea of five in contradistinction to the fives of straight lines, circles, and so on. But I do not think that they are right. Aristotle's testimony is quite clear that Plato did not admit any ideas of numbers. The ideas are intellectual or noetic, not sensible. Did I say ideas? Yeah, no, I want to say the numbers or other mathematical things are not sensible, but noetic, intellectual. Because you can never see a straight line. You can never draw a straight line. It's always smudged somehow. The line of which the geometer talks is not the line which we see at the table or which he draws at the table. And the same is true of ideas. All justice we find in the world, in men or in actions or in institutions, is imperfect, as imperfect as the straight line drawn on the blackboard. And therefore they point to something which can no longer be seen with the bodily eye, but only with the eyes of the mind, and these are the noetic things. And the noetic things consist of these two branches, the mathematical things and the ideas. And I think the reason why this the simplest sign of the difference between the ideas and the mathematical things is the multiplicity of the noetic things in mathematics. You see, in the case of dogs, a great multiplicity of dogs, one idea of dog, but the multiplicity is a multiplicity of dogs we see, of sensible dogs. Sensible not in the sense of housebroken, but in the sense of being visible to the eyes. We do now remove this